consider it one of the most important political appointments to be made. Governor Clinton chose his attorney general. A stunning choice. An amazing man to be attorney general, one from an extraordinary family. He entered Princeton University at the age of 13 and graduated 3 years later. Brilliant. It was in the year 1800 that Governor George Clinton of New York appointed Aaron Burr as Attorney General and launched him on his way so that he became the United States Senator from New York and eventually candidate for President of the United States. It was the only time in our country's history when the election went quite as it did, for there was a tie in the Electoral College. And the Constitution required that the determination of who would be president and who would be vice president be decided in the United States House of Representatives. There were 36 ballots before it was finally decided that Thomas Jefferson would be the president and Aaron Burr, coming in second, would be the vice president. Aaron Burr was on his way to a meteoric political career. He was powerful. He was well-liked, popular. And then the decline began. He engaged in a conflict, an argument, with his former law partner in New York City, Alexander Hamilton. He challenged him to a duel that was held on the banks of the river in Weehawken, New Jersey. Two shots were fired, and Alexander Hamilton lay dead. And Aaron Burr, the vice president of the United States, was indicted in New Jersey courts for murder. Rather than face trial, he fled back to Washington, D.C., where he served out his term as vice president. And then there were accusations of treason. It was said that he wanted this country and European allies to engage in a war against Mexico, and that once Mexico was conquered, he would be declared the king of Mexico, and that he intended to annex all of the North American continent west of the Allegheny Mountains. In face of indictment in New Jersey and accusations of treason, he fled the country. He sailed for England and from England on to the continent. And there he fell further into abject poverty, and he wanted to come home. But he couldn't get a passport. He couldn't leave Europe. What must it have been like for a man who was once a heartbeat away from the President of the United States, unable to return home? Do you think that perhaps it was like the same emotion felt by Peter, who had so long lived in the inner circle of the followers of Jesus, who had been only a heartbeat away from the Messiah, who on that tragic, confusing night before the crucifixion, three times between sunset and sunrise, denied that he even knew Jesus? He didn't need to be indicted or convicted, because he knew, and everyone else knew, that he was guilty. And Peter must have wondered if he could ever return home again to Jesus. Could he ever be forgiven? Would there ever be a passport back? The answers come at the very end of John's New Testament Gospel. It's on pages 1688 and 1689 in our Pew Bibles, from John chapter 21, verses 15 through 25. When they had finished eating breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than these?" "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my lambs." Again, Jesus said, "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me?" "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." "Take care of my sheep." The third time, he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, "Do you love me?" He said, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my sheep. I tell you the truth. When you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go." Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Then he said to him, "Follow me." Peter turned and saw that the disciple whom Jesus loved was following him. This was the one who had leaned back against Jesus at the supper and had said, "Lord, who is going to betray you?" When Peter saw him, he asked, "Lord, what about him?" Jesus answered, "If I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? You must follow me." Because of this, the rumor spread among the brothers that this disciple would not die. But Jesus did not say that he would not die. He only said, "If I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you?" This is the disciple who testifies to these things and who wrote them down. We know that his testimony is true. Jesus did many other things as well. If every one of them were written down, I suppose that even the whole world would not have room for the books that would be written. Have you ever been picked out of a crowd to do something when you prefer to stay anonymous? One time our family was on vacation in South Florida, and on our itinerary, for reasons that I have forgotten, was a visit in the Miami area to the parrot jungle. And, you know, it's really a little strange to me that we or anybody else would want to pay money to go see these dirty birds. But we did. And we were in this little amphitheater. There were scores of people that were there. And they had a few parrots up front and an MC. And she asked for volunteers. And I don't volunteer. And so I didn't. And she picked me anyway. And brought me up front. I said no, but I don't know. She didn't take no for an answer. And she got me up there to play poker with this parrot. So she had these huge cards, and she would deal them out, and she gave me 5 cards, and she gave the parrot 5 cards. And I don't know. I mean, if you really want to make a fool out of yourself, play poker with a parrot sometime in front of a whole lot of people. And I think it was rigged because I'm a little embarrassed to tell you that the parrot won. Now, it's hard to describe the emotions that I felt. I didn't want to do it. I just did it reluctantly. It was after breakfast. That was a while after the resurrection. That the 11 were sitting around with Jesus, and Jesus picked Peter. Peter was the most reluctant of all. He didn't want to be picked because he still remembered what he had done. And so did everyone else. No one mentioned it. Nobody said anything about it. But everyone knew. Jesus focused in on him and said, "Simon, son of John." And Peter's heart must begin to pound, 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 pound. "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than these?" Peter got it. This was his window of opportunity. He could be back on good terms with Jesus. Jesus was giving him another chance. And so he said, "Yes, Lord." Loud and clear. "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." A smile filled his face. But then Jesus spoke again. He said, "Feed my lambs." Whatever that meant, I don't think Peter knew. Nor do I think that he cared. He was just delighted for the opportunity to be right with Jesus again and get on with his life again. But it was then that Jesus said, "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me?" Peter must have been surprised. I think perhaps irritated. But we all feel rather uncomfortable when someone asks us a question and we give a straightforward and honest answer, and then the person asks the question all over again as if there's some other agenda that is here. He must have wondered, didn't Jesus hear? He hadn't had a lot of experience with resurrected people. Maybe he thought he couldn't hear as well as he used to, or his hearing had sort of died off when he had died off, and it would come back later. And so he said, "Yes, Lord, you know I love you." Make sure that Jesus would this time hear it. But when Jesus opened his mouth the third time, Peter's heart must have sunk. Once was wonderful. Twice was questionable. But not three times. Not three times. Not the same number of times that Peter had denied Jesus. And so, without ever mentioning what Peter had done, Jesus brought the whole issue out of the past and into the present. It was not a cruel thing to do. For often, yesterday's sins so control our lives that if we do not confront and confess yesterday's sins, it is a virtual impossibility to get life back on the right track and on to where it ought to go. The historian John writes that Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." He was hurt. His feelings were hurt. But he needed to be hurt because he needed to be helped. It was somewhat like the old story of the physician, the surgeon, who, as a last desperation, he was the only one that could do it or his son's life would be lost. He had to operate on his own son. And in the final moments before the anesthesia was administered, his boy looked at him and said, "Daddy, you're not going to hurt me, are you?" His father looked at him and said, "Yes, I'm going to hurt you. But I would never harm you." Jesus hurt Peter, not to harm him, but to help him. When Jesus asked, "Do you truly love me more than these?" Peter may have been confused. These what? Could it mean that Jesus meant the fish? They had just had the record catch in all the history of the lake called Galilee, 153 in the net, so heavy that they could barely pick it up. Peter was a fisherman by trade. He had done it all his life. He was good at it. He was successful. And now he had the biggest catch of all, and soon he would take it to market, and that would increase his success, his prosperity. It would push on his career. It was a good day for a fisherman. And now Jesus was asking, "Peter, do you love me more than you love these fish?" I suppose if he were asking us today, he would say, "Do you love me more than you love this money? Possessions? Do you love me more than job? Children? Husband or wife? Do you love me more than your customers or your clients? It's been a little bit better lately. The economy's been picking up. You've got a lot of contracts. You're looking forward to the commission checks. The tough days are a little bit behind. The contracts are all there on the desk." And he says, "Do you love me more than these?" It's a good question. But maybe that's not what Jesus meant at all. Perhaps Jesus was asking, "Peter, do you truly love me more than these?" And pointed to the other 10 of his followers that were sitting around the breakfast fire early that morning. And that went back to a conversation recorded not by John, but by Matthew in chapter 26 of his biography of Jesus. It too took place on the last night before Jesus' crucifixion when Jesus had predicted that his followers would defect. They would scatter when they faced the reality of what was going to happen. And Peter had protested that night. He had put himself up against all of the others and said, "Even if all fall away on account of you, I never will." And now perhaps Jesus was saying, "Peter, you once insisted that you were more loyal than any of the others. But this morning the issue is not loyalty. This morning the issue is love. And so I'm asking you, Peter, do you love me more than these other guys?" I don't know how to answer a question like that. I don't know how to answer a question like that for myself here today, because I don't know how much anybody else loves Jesus. It's kind of a goofy thing when you think about it. How do you figure that out? Who here loves Jesus the most in this room? And the least? Let's suppose we were to go outside and line up in order. Right? Number one lover of Jesus, number seven, number 12, number 530, number 1014, and somebody last. Do you love Jesus more than these? Now, I don't know how to answer that question. But I tell you how I'd like to answer it. I'd like to answer it the way Peter answered it. When he said, "Jesus, you know everything. And so you know. You know. I love you." Yeah, but anybody can say, "I love you." Words are easy, sometimes cheap. The real proof of love is never in words. The real proof is in what love does. So Jesus said to Peter, "Peter, you know, you say it, but prove it. Feed my lambs, take care of my sheep, feed my sheep." And so for Peter, the proof was in the obedience that he would serve those whom Jesus had a special relationship with, for whom Jesus was the shepherd. Take care of them, service them, give to them. Obey me. I was listening to a tape this past week in which someone said that giving is never a financial decision. It is always a spiritual decision. I never thought much about that before, but I think that's true. So if I don't give my time and give my money and give what's important in life to my wife, then I really don't love her, do I? And likewise, those who say, "I love you, Jesus." But if we don't do what he says, if we don't give him our time, if we give him little or none of our money, if we offer him only those things which are unimportant in our lives, then we're just not telling the truth. Because love always, always does. Jesus next spoke some shocking words. No one could have predicted he was going to say this. He turned to Peter and said, "Peter, I'm going to tell you the truth. When you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted, but when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go." And then John, the historian, explains this, because otherwise we wouldn't quite know what was meant. Jesus said these words, to indicate what kind of death Peter would die and would glorify God. And then Jesus said to Peter, "Follow me." Have you ever thought about how you're going to die? I know you have, because I have, and I assume everybody does. We wonder about that, and we wonder about when, but we all wonder about how. Cancer? Long and protracted. And painful. Or a heart attack. Never know it's coming. Just gone. Or asphyxiation. Frightening way to die. Or maybe you watch television and there have been a lot of murders around lately. I think one of these days I might go into a Tom Thumb or a 7-Eleven store and they'll be robbed and there'll be a bullet and I'll be shot, and there I'll realize 30 seconds before I'm going to die, this is it.
There isn't time for anybody to call 911 and get me help. The help wouldn't get here in time. Or maybe it would be by drowning. Or, ever wonder? Wonder how you're going to die? Jesus told Peter how he was going to die. That he was going to die with his hands outstretched, and immediately Peter and everyone else knew exactly what Jesus was talking about. Peter was going to die the same way that Jesus had died, by crucifixion. That was right after Jesus told Peter, who had just said that he loved Jesus, right after Jesus told him how he was going to die, that Jesus said to him, "Now follow me. Come on, follow me." Loving Jesus is often not easy. The price can come very high. Suppose he asks you, "Do you love me?" You say, "Yeah, I love you." And he says, "Okay, I'll tell you what that's going to cost. This is how you're going to die." And then he says, "Now that you've got that, follow me." Would you follow him? Peter did. The traditions and the history say that Peter died in Rome in the year AD 65 under the terror reign of the Emperor Nero, that he was crucified. Loving Jesus, following Jesus, cost Peter his life. Not few of us will ever know in advance either the cost of love or how we will die. Peter knew both, and he followed Jesus anyway. Because? Hey, because he truly loved Jesus. And love always does. But Peter wasn't perfect. The moment Jesus told Peter how he was going to die, he looked around at the other guys and said, "Jesus, what about him?" And pointed to John. Because Peter, who was always quick to think and quicker to speak, thought to himself, "You know, if I'm going to be crucified, I wouldn't want to do that alone. I mean, who would want to be crucified alone? So, John, how about you? You want to come along?" And John said, not me. Jesus basically answered, "Peter, that's really not your problem. If I want him to remain until I return, what is that to you? Just follow me, Peter." What Jesus taught was no comparisons. Peter, like us, wanted to compare. We all want to do that. We want to say, "Hey, you know, I go to church. I'm a Christian. I pray. I do all the stuff you're supposed to do. So how come she comes out better than I do? Well, why is life so easy for her and so hard for me?" We say, "Well, why does he get what he wants and I don't get what I want? Well, why is my marriage in trouble and their marriage seems to be okay? I mean, how come? How come that my kids have all the problems they have? And I don't see that they're any different than I am. And they don't seem to have any problems with their kids. Why am I out of work when everybody else seems to have a job?" We all love this business of comparison. But Jesus says, when you really love me, you are so focused on me. And our relationship is so central, so primary, that you shouldn't compare. "I'll deal with her as I deal with her, and I'll deal with him as I deal with him, and I'll deal with you as I deal with you. It will be a love relationship. I will do you no harm. Love me. And follow me." And so Christians who truly love Jesus, let him choose. Who lives? Who dies? Who works? Who doesn't? Who's rich? Who's poor? Who's single? Who's married? Whose life is easy? Whose life is hard? Our purpose in life is not to have it some other way. Our purpose in life is to love and to follow Jesus. And whatever happened to Aaron Burr? Well, after 4 years, he got a passport. and he finally came home. Maybe you know how Aaron Burr felt. Maybe you know from your own experience the emotions of Peter. Because maybe you too have said and done some stupid and sinful things that have left you distant from God, alone from Jesus. It's a rotten feeling. You wonder if you could ever be forgiven. You wonder if there's ever another chance, if you can ever start again. I can't speak for those from whom you might be alienated, or for the passport office of the United States. But I can tell you about Jesus. And I can tell you that he welcomes back even those who have denied him. All he asks is, do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me more than these? More than these. And we answer. Let's bow our heads and each of us answer, silently praying our answers to Jesus when he asks, do you truly love me more than these? Tell him, yes, Lord. You know all things. You know that I love you.
Mike Kenfield comes to the platform at this time to share a portion of his faith story with us. Mike, thank you for sharing. Today is my birthday, and I never thought I'd be spending it quite like this, but here I am. Birthdays are a time for gifts and celebrations, and I look forward to that later this afternoon. Yet the gifts I've been thinking about the most recently are those that were given to me before my other birthday, my spiritual birth. Yeah, I grew up a doubting Thomas. As a child and a youth, I simply didn't believe in God and saw no need for him in my life. It wasn't until I was in college, pursuing a career in music, that I began to wonder if I was experiencing all that life had to offer. I felt that there had to be something more, and I wanted to know what it was. This was a private, personal search. I didn't go out asking people to tell me what they knew about life, and yet, time and time again, I found myself in situations where I was talking with people who believed in the God of the Bible and had a personal faith in Jesus Christ. I couldn't get away from them. I remember, for example, attending a funeral with a friend of mine. He told me that, unlike me, he knew there was more to life than the here and now, and that he had a confidence and a hope for the hereafter. Or my saxophone teacher, who in a very candid moment told me how his separation from his wife and their divorce would have been virtually impossible for him to endure if it wasn't for the comfort that he had in his relationship with Christ. Or my coworkers at a music camp, who called themselves Christians and possessed a certain quality that I found attractive and impossible to ignore. They had a sincere concern for people, they had a deeply felt joy for life, and they had a confidence about the future. Not one of these people witnessed to me, at least not in the sense of presenting God's plan of salvation and asking me then and there to make a decision. But in another sense, they were the most authentic of witnesses. For in the normal, ordinary events of their lives, they talked naturally about their relationship with God and the difference that it was making for them. These people were a gift. Their words and their actions challenged me to learn more about their God. I began to pray, asking God that if he was there, he would show himself to me. And he did. It happened during a summer vacation in Washington, D.C. I had spent the day touring the recently opened Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, marveling at the complexity of the airplanes and the spacecraft that they had displayed there. But then, outside, I looked at the trees around me. And at that moment, I knew there had to be a God. How else could I possibly explain the complexity of those marvelous things? I had discovered what Paul talked about in the first chapter of Romans, that the world declares the handiwork of God, and that we can see God through His creation. This was certainly another gift, and yet I did not know this God personally. That fall, I moved to Boston to attend a music school. Now, I had started reading the New Testament, but understood very little about what I was reading. So I went to the library to find a book that might help me out. Walking up and down the rows and rows of books in the religion section, not really knowing what I was looking for, I pulled a little book from the shelves, Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. A coincidence? I don't think so. This was another gift. In that book, I learned about a personal God who loved me and desired to restore my broken relationship with Him. I understood His greatest gift, that of Jesus Christ, said yes, and accepted His salvation. Now, God was the giver of all these gifts, His people, His world, His word, and most importantly, Himself. And I'm confident that He is still working in this world and desiring to give these gifts today. I'm learning that while our physical births are a time for receiving gifts, our spiritual birth makes us givers of these very gifts. I want to be more and more a gift giver, one who lives out my life of faith, shares my testimony, and is open and available to the people around me. I realize I may never know the effects of these many ordinary gifts, but I, for one, am literally eternally grateful to God and to the many people who gave their gifts to me.